This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
We're going to get started about the second half of the meeting. We're going to have a debate, which is on an important area. Related to the management of HCC. So we continue to have a great deal of controversy about managing patients who have very early stage HCC, and today we're focusing on patients who have T1 lesions that measure a single lesion between 1 to 1.9 centimeters. So we're going to have a debate, and the way I would organize this is that we'll hear each side, and then I'm going to ask the audience to take a vote at the end. So our two participants, are they here? Okay. So two participants are here, Dr. Rio Hirose and Dr. Neil Mehta. Dr. Hirose, both of our participants really have a great deal of passion and expertise in HCC. Rio really is our go-to guy. He's a transplant surgeon, but our go-to guy in doing all the laparoscopic radiofrequency ablation and doing a lot of resections for patients with HCC. He also chairs the UNOS Liver and Intestinal Committee, and is really instrumental in making positive changes in policies related to liver transplantation, whether it's HCC or non-HCC. And it's also a pleasure to introduce Dr. Neil Mehta, our newest hepatologist, and I'm really proud to be able to recruit Neil to be my partner in HCC, and Neil already developed a very a strong niche in the area related to liver transplant and organ allocation policy for HCC. And before I let the two of them have a lot of fun debating, I'll just start with a very brief introduction, mainly focusing on some of the changes that we're seeing related to organ allocation and liver transplant for HCC, and kind of set the stage with a case for this debate between Neil and Rio. So we are all aware of the, we are all familiar with the Milan criteria, which really has been the cornerstone for selection of candidates for liver transplantation. And it's been adopted by UNOS for giving priority to patients with HCC. So you can see here the Milan criteria is divided into T1 and also T2. So T1 means a single nodule under 2 centimeters, and then T2 is one nodule between 2 to 5 centimeter, or 2 to 3 nodules, each of these nodules within 3 centimeters. So we probably don't need to worry about anything beyond T2 for now, other than downstaging, but that's not the topic of our discussion. So currently only patients with HCC meeting T2 criteria are eligible for receiving priority listing for liver transplantation under the MEL system that was implemented back in 2002. So that means that patients who had T1 lesions are not eligible for priority listing. And why is that? So initially, in the old days, a patient with T1 HCC, they got priority, but a large percentage of those patients at the time of transplant turned out not to have any HCC. So that's one reason. The other reason is that, you know, these patients seem to have a low rate of dropout, falling off the waiting list. So right now, only patients meeting T2 criteria as defined here are given priority, the MELD exception points for liver transplantation. One of the problems that we have faced over the years is that on a national scale, we see lack of uniform imaging diagnostic criteria. If you have two small lesions, like each one of them is about 1 centimeter, you know, you get priority because that meets T2 criteria. But, you know, are they truly HCC? So that has been a really important issue about potential misdiagnosis for patients who turn out not to have HCC. So going back to 2005, the ASLD guidelines came out with the idea that you don't really need liver biopsy to confirm the diagnosis of HCC. The diagnosis can be based on cross-sectional imaging with contrast-enhanced either CT or MRI showing typical HCC characteristics, and that they define as arterial phase hypervascularity. Like they look hot during the arterial phase, and then you have this fading out or washout effect during portal venous phase. But in fact, we're moving beyond the ASLD criteria now, using even more stringent criteria to define HCC based on radiographic criteria. And this is what we call the LIRES system, the Liver Imaging Reporting and Data System, and it's endorsed by the American College of Radiology. The aim is to provide standardized reporting of CT or MRI imaging in HCC in patients with cirrhosis or other risk factors. So it's classified into five groups, LIRES 1 through 5. 1 means definitely benign, 2 is probably benign, 3 is indeterminate. We see a lot of indeterminate. 4 is probable, and then 5 is definite. So this system is, what is it based on? What are the major diagnostic criteria? So it's still important to have arterial phase hyperenhancement and then delayed phase washout. So these are the two probably most important criteria. Pseudocapsule basically is a rim of hypervascularity, usually seen in equilibrium phase, and our radiologists think that, you know, you only see that in a minority of HCC patients. And then also interval growth. There's some modification by urinals, and now the interval growth is by 50% or higher on serial CT MRI less than 6 months apart. And this system is designed to separate those less than 2 centimeter versus those at least 2 centimeters, because the one less than 2 centimeter, the criteria are even more stringent because we don't want to be, you know, looking at cancers that turn out not to be cancer in the explant. So this is a typical example. You have a large, you have a single lesion here that enhances during the arterial phase, and then you clearly see the washout during the portal venous phase. That's typical. And then this is a pseudocapsule that sometimes we can find, but it's not always easy. So this is the slide I'd like to walk you through. It's not as complicated as it looks. So let's focus on a liver lesion that's at least 2 centimeters, okay? That is hypervascular, okay? If it's hypervascular at least 2 centimeter, the only thing you need to be a LIRES 5 is washout, okay? So you need one criteria, typically washout. So arterial phase enhancement and then washout, then you classify that as a LIRES 5. If you have more than one, that's good too. It's very difficult for you to have LIRES 5 or class 5 criteria if you have a smaller lesion between 1 to 1.9 centimeter. So you need two criteria, either pseudocapsule or interval growth, 50% within 6 months. If you have a hypovascular lesion, which may account for 20% of all cases of HCC, you'd never be able to call it HCC unless you have a biopsy. Okay. So that brings up the point that you have a, you know, 3 centimeter tumor that you strongly suspect to HCC, but not meeting LIRES 5 criteria, you may have to do a biopsy to confirm the diagnosis. So as of the end of October, this new system is now in place. So if you send a patient to us and then we tell in order to meet certain criteria, we need to do a biopsy or need to do some additional testing. That's because we are now under the system where the diagnosis of HCC is extremely stringent. So only class 5 or Lyrette 5 patients are eligible for getting mail exception for liver transplantation. So just a background about some of the changes that we are seeing, and we already talked about a biopsy. We are not a big fan of biopsy because of, sometimes false negative biopsies, very common, and lead to delay in diagnosis or treatment, and then seeding along the biopsy track. We don't really know the incidence, but, it may be in the range of 1 to 5%. In selected cases, if you have atypical radiographic characteristics, biopsy is probably a good idea. So to set the stage for the debate, I'll present a case. This is a 56-year-old man with chronic hepatitis C who has portal hypertension, one episode of variceal bleeding in 2011, treated with banding, and had a surveillance CT showing a 1.6 centimeter hypervascular lesion washout located in segment 7 of the right lobe. MRI confirmed this to be about 1.5 centimeter. No complication liver disease, good social support, no active substance abuse issues. Past history only significant for hypertension on treatment. Stopped alcohol 2011, never had heavy alcohol use. Examination, spiders, hypertrophy of the left hepatic lobe, a caudate, big spleen, no ascites edema, no asterixis. And the lab, you see low platelet 56, sodium normal, bilirubin 1.5, albumin 3.6, normal creatinine, ARP is 46, not very helpful. So you have a MEL score of 9 and a CTP score of 5. So this is a CT showing the single lesion, typical washout, so it's HCC, but it's only 1.5 centimeter. So right now this patient doesn't qualify for priority listing for liver transplantation. So what do we do? Okay, so this is a T1 HCC 1.5 centimeter. You talk to the surgeon, they would probably say it's not a great candidate for resection because you have portal hypertension, big spleen, low platelet, you have varices from prior bleeding, so probably not a great resection candidate because these patients decompensate after resection if you do an anatomical resection. So one approach is to wait and not ablate. So you wait until the tumor grows, until you see the tumor becoming T2, whether it's a single lesion, 2 centimeter, or a couple lesions. You wait and then you treat, because after that, that patient meet criteria for priority listing, so you go move towards liver transplant as the endpoint. The other option in this debate will be try to ablate the patient right away, immediate treatment. Forget about transplant for the time being. If the patient had recurrent of disease, then we can consider that. So that's the argument. For the argument is Dr. Hirose. So I'm sure that you'll hear about, issues related to dropout from the waiting list, the long-term outcome, tumor recurrence, eligibility for transplant, and the availability of organs to proceed with liver transplant. So let's start with Neil. Okay, to talk about his point of view about what to do in this patient. And it's the
okay. Thank you very much, Francis. So I'll be taking the wait and not ablate strategy, which I'm going to try to convince you is the right approach here today. So we kind of already went through this, but just to reiterate, patients with T1 HCC or a single lesion under 2 centimeters no longer eligible for priority listing for transplant. So Rio's going to talk to you about immediate radiofrequency ablation. So before he gets to go, I get to tell you some of the issues with that. Certainly other local regional therapy also can be undertaken, but most of the data out there is on radiofrequency ablation immediately after the diagnosis is made. some of the problems with immediate radiofrequency ablation. One of them is that even with when you have a very small, less than 2 centimeter lesion, we still see very high rates of tumor recurrence. So the estimations based on several large studies actually is that 5-year recurrence-free survival for immediate radiofrequency ablation of a T1 lesion is somewhere between 38 and 60%. So not exactly excellent, I would say, when we know that transplant can do much better. Some of the other issues with immediate RFA that Dr. Yao kind of already alluded to, but the diagnostic accuracy of cross-sectional imaging in both in liver biopsy definitely decrease as your tumor size gets smaller and smaller. So we know, we already talked about explant data that arterial enhancing lesions less than 2 centimeters very often are not HCC. There's a very low sensitivity of MRI if you use strict criteria of both arterial hypervascularity and washout. So if you need both of those criteria, MRI is only 60% sensitive for that. And also, if you go to biopsy these patients, you have a 30% false negative rate. So the approach of immediate radiofrequency ablation then is very difficult if you are having a hard time making the diagnosis. And then the last problem with immediate radiofrequency ablation is that these are non-resection candidates. By definition, they have portal hypertension, they have liver dysfunction, and certainly many of these patients are going to eventually need liver transplantation. So what is the wait and not ablate approach? Well, basically, we're going to wait until the patient grows till stage T2 HCC, and then we're going to do local regional therapy. In this setting, once they grow to T2, they can be listed for liver transplantation, and this serves a dual purpose. Obviously, you correct their underlying liver dysfunction, and also you get complete oncologic resection. Many studies now have shown that there's excellent 5-year post-transplant survival for patients transplanted within T2 HCC, probably somewhere in the 75 to 80%. And as we're getting better and better with transplant, with organ allocation, our recurrence rates are definitely decreasing. We used to think maybe 10 to 15%. Now we're thinking more like 7% HCC recurrence post-transplant. So excellent numbers. So this patient that Dr. Yao presented, a 1.5 centimeter lesion, so he's sitting in my office and we have to discuss. I'm going to tell him, all right, we're not going to do anything, and I'm sure he's going to ask me questions. So in order to convince him and to convince you that wait and not ablate is the right strategy, some of the questions I'm sure that he's thinking about and that I have to convince him. So he's going to ask, what is the risk of tumor progression directly from T1 or my current 1.5 centimeter lesion to outside of transplant criteria? So within 3 months, 6 months, when you do his next imaging, it grows directly from 1.5 centimeters to 8 centimeters, or worse yet, to a metastatic lesion in the lungs. So what is that risk? What is the overall intention to treat outcome for T1 patients? So that's certainly data that he'll want to know. How long is he going to be waiting? So what's the median time to progression beyond T1? And finally, what are the risk factors that we as clinicians can look into to determine if a patient likely is going to have rapid tumor progression or certainly exclusion from liver transplantation? Because if we can identify those risk factors, then certainly this is something that we can then use to kind of make sure that we're doing the right approach by wait and not ablate instead of immediate treatment. So the UCSF experience, we have now studied 311 consecutive patients with an initial lesion measuring 1 to 1.9 centimeters by either contrast-enhanced CT or MRI at our multidisciplinary tumor board reviewed between 2004 and 2012. 53 of these patients did not have liver dysfunction or portal hypertension and therefore were thought to be resection candidates and were excluded. Of the remaining 258, 120 of them on all follow-up imaging neither had tumor visualization or tumor growth, and therefore were not thought to be actually have HCC, and therefore were also excluded. Of the remaining 138 patients, 24 of them underwent immediate treatment, often for reasons such as either they have a very high AFP or they're not transplant candidates, often this group actually from advanced age. So the other 114 made up our study cohort. These are the patients that underwent the wait and not ablate approach until meeting T2 HCC criteria. And these are the patients that we're closely observing with serial CT or MRI every 3 months until they progress beyond T1. In terms of the baseline clinical characteristics, you'll see they're very similar to the patient that Dr. Yao presented. A median age of 60. The majority were male. 47% were Caucasian with about a third being Hispanic, and the rest Hispanic or African-American. Hepatitis C was the most common etiology of liver disease at about 57%. though hepatitis B, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and alcoholic liver disease were also fairly common. Just similar to our patient who had a MELD score of 9 and was Child Pugh A, that's very common. Our median MELD was 10, and the majority of patients were either Childs A or B. What about baseline tumor characteristics when T1 was diagnosed? The median tumor size was 1.4 centimeters, and it was about half split between patients who were 1 to 1.4 centimeters or patients 1 to 1.5 to 1.9 centimeters. At diagnosis, the median AFP was 12, with 60% having an AFP of 20 or less, and only 5% having an AFP of over 500. Going back to our earlier point of T1 HCC being often challenging to diagnose, 10% of patients did not have hypervascularity, and a good quarter of the group actually did not have delayed washout. So what were our results with this approach? We had 114 patients. Two of them died while they were within T1 for non-HCC reasons. Six of them still currently remain within T1. So 100 of the patients, or 88%, did what we were hoping they would do. They progressed directly from T1 to within T2 criteria at a median of 7 months. And then there were six patients who progressed directly from T1 to outside of conventional transplant criteria at a median of 5 months. And we'll come back to those six patients in a moment. We had decent follow-up of 2.4 years. So what were the outcomes of the 100 patients who progressed from T1 to within T2? 53 of them underwent transplant. 22 of them are still listed for transplant enrollment. 12% dropped out from the waiting list. We'll also come back to that group. And then finally, 13% of the group actually did not get listed for liver and transplantation for other reasons. So the overall Kaplan-Meier intention to treat survival of this cohort was pretty good, 95% at 1 year and 76% at 3 years. So certainly a question that this patient was going to ask us, so this is a good data that you can suggest. 76% 3 year survival is pretty good. The median increase in total tumor diameter overall was quite slow at 0.14 centimeters per month. When patients progress beyond T1, the majority, or 73%, actually had a single lesion, so that would have been 2 centimeters or greater by definition, whereas 23% had 2 lesions and only 5% had 3 or more lesions. And not surprisingly, the time to progression beyond T1 was significantly longer for patients who started out with a smaller tumor at 9 months versus if they have a slightly larger tumor at 1.5 to 1.9, it was only 6 months. And then finally, rapid tumor progression, which there's no definition, so we defined it as a greater than 1 centimeter increase in total tumor diameter over 3 months. So about 20% of our cohort had this feature of rapid tumor progression. And so certainly, we want to be able to try to capture this group. Who are these 20% of people who are having tumors that are growing quite rapidly? So when we looked at predictors, the three that we found were Hispanic race ethnicity as compared to Caucasians. Patients who had alcoholic liver disease also had rapid tumor progression, more likely. And then finally, hepatitis B appeared to be protective against rapid tumor progression. None of the other demographic factors or tumor-related factors, such as size, AFP, or arterial vascularity or washout, was predictive of having a rapidly growing tumor. So I told you we'd come back to those six patients who progressed directly from T1 to beyond T2. So this is 5.3% of our cohort, so a relatively small number, actually. So 4 of these patients progressed directly to beyond T2 just on tumor burden alone. So again, this patient who has a 1.5 centimeter lesion, if they had progressed to an 8 centimeter lesion, that would be in this group. A fifth patient had a portal vein tumor thrombus 3 months after diagnosis of T1 HCC, and the last patient had an adrenal metastasis 7 months after T1 HCC was diagnosed. So the competing risk cumulative probabilities of having progression from T1 to directly beyond T2 was 4.4% at 6 months and 9% at 2 years. So we had those 6 patients who were excluded from liver transplant, and we also had 12 patients who were excluded from liver transplant after they were listed for liver transplant. So they grew from T1 to within T2 and then dropped out due to tumor progression or liver-related death. So with these 18 events, we did an analysis of predictors of exclusion from transplant, and the two that we found were basically if a patient at the time of diagnosis of T1 disease had an AFP of 500 or greater, or if they had this definition of rapid tumor progression. So either one of those two, these are patients who are much more likely to drop out. So overall, how can I try to convince you that this is the right strategy? Well, certainly T1-HCC generally grows slowly. The median increase in total tumor diameter of our cohort was only 0.4 centimeters every 3 months. We think this is a reflection of good tumor biology. These are tumors that are small, and as they're being detected by screening, by definition, these are going to be tumors that are less aggressive than patients who present to the emergency room with a tumor that's causing symptoms. The median time to progression beyond T1 was 7 months. And so most importantly, when this patient in clinic asks us, we can say this wait and not ablate approach, less than 5% of patients are going to have a risk of progression directly to beyond transplant criteria, at 6 months, and less than 10% at 2 years. And I'll kind of throw the question out there, but those patients who are presenting with a portal vein tumor thrombus 3 months after they're diagnosed with a very small lesion, these are likely patients who are going to have a bad outcome no matter what. We did tell you that we had an excellent 1 in 3 year intention to treat survival of 95 and 76%. And then to compare this to immediate radiofrequency ablation, we know, like I said before, like Dr. Yao said, these are lesions that are very hard to diagnose. And so this is a strategy of waiting and not ablating that is perfect. You don't know if this patient actually has cancer. Let's wait and watch them. If they have interval growth, we'll diagnose with them with HCC, and then they'll grow to 2 centimeters, and then we can treat them and list them. If you try to immediately radiofrequency ablation for all patients with a less than 2 centimeter tumor that is hypervascular, I think you're going to be doing a lot of unnecessary radiofrequency ablations. And if you do immediate radiofrequency ablation on all patients with just hypervascularity and delayed washout, you're missing a quarter of our group who actually did have HCC without those classic definitions. So it's, I think, with a wait and not ablate approach is very nice in this difficult to diagnose situation. Over half of our cohort was either Child's B or C. And so in this case, you know, liver transplant is going to be most likely necessary. And so in this case, it allows for complete oncologic resection. It allows for resolution of liver dysfunction. You don't run the risk of doing a radiofrequency ablation and causing a large ablation cavity and having a patient decompensate and not And then finally, the recurrence rates after radiofrequency ablation are clearly much higher than the recurrence rates after liver transplantation. So I'll then just close by telling you that while I think this is a great strategy, it's not for everybody. So I mentioned that 87% of the patients who we progressed to within T2 got listed. But what about those 13% who didn't? Kind of the data nationally is about around half of patients who have stage T2 HCC actually get listed for transplant. So there's a very high percentage of patients who aren't candidates. And so in this group, we, you know, 87% is very good. It's better than national average, but the goal is 100%, right? There's not really a reason to do wait and not ablate in someone who's not a transplant candidate. So we really do need to pay close attention to comorbid medical conditions, psychosocial issues that affect liver transplant candidacy before applying the strategy. And certainly patients who come in with an AFP of greater than 500 or someone who has rapid tumor progression, these are patients that appear to be at high risk for exclusion from transplant and should receive immediate local regional therapy, likely with radiofrequency ablation. So going back to our case, this is the 59-year-old gentleman with a 1.5 centimeter tumor. They don't have any risk factors for rapid tumor progression. Their AFP is well under 500. It's only 46. He clearly has portal hypertension. His platelet count's 50. He has a variceal bleed, and he's an excellent liver transplant candidate. He has all the all the criteria that will make him an excellent wait not ablate patient. Thank you.
Thank you. Rio is chopping his knife. So.
So I was assigned by Francis to argue the ablate, don't wait side of the equation. And I don't have any financial disclosures, but I have to disclose a few things to you all. So I'm a liver transplant surgeon, and I love doing liver transplants. So to argue that this guy shouldn't have a liver transplant, I won't be so sad if all of you vote that they should just have a liver transplant. I love performing liver transplants on patients with HCC. It's like the easiest thing of all time. They are totally sweet. They don't have as much portal hypertension. They're not so sick. They don't have renal failure. They're not intubated in the ICU. And they do wonderfully. So You know, I'm sort of arguing the other side of the coin, which is don't transplant these guys. Because if you want to wait and get to the point where you're a candidate for liver transplant, that's okay. Neil just made a good argument that you can get away with it. Okay, so that doesn't mean that it's right, though. Does it mean that we want to transplant every one of these? The other disclosure is that I actually chair the HCC subcommittee to look at whether we're giving HCC patients too much priority. And I'm currently actually the vice chair, Francis, of the UNOS Liver Intestinal Committee. So if I don't do a terrible job, I might actually ostensibly be the chair of the UNOS Liver Intestinal Committee. So I actually can change the rules and make it such that Neil's argument actually doesn't make any sense. The last thing is, I not only like Neil, but I like Neil and Monica and Jen and Daniel. I love all of our newer hepatologists. They're awesome. So I was told to go gentle. All right. Now, the first thing I have to disagree a little bit is that Neil makes it sound like RFA is a terrible treatment for a small HTC. You know, he says that you can get 38 to 60% recurrence rate at 5 years. And there's no doubt that if you wait long enough, if someone has an HTC, that they'll probably recur because you have this fertile field of a cirrhotic liver and they'll eventually get one. But if you look at and some of the more recent reports, what is the actual efficacy of local regional therapy for these small HCCs? Well, if you look at the most recent data, many of these trials, if you look at them, there's tens and maybe even 20 or 30 reports of long-term follow-up with radiofrequency ablation, some of which are randomized control between RFA and RFA plus TACE or RFA versus resection. But just one recent one, for example, reported results of RFA versus resection with literally a single HCC less than 2 centimeters. What was the RFA result? Well, they had pretty short operative times, very little blood loss, and a pretty short hospital stay. So given that person sitting across from you, which would you rather have? Would you rather just go ahead with a liver transplant or have a little outpatient procedure where you're discharged the next day? I don't know which one he'd pick if you gave him those choices. But if you look at the survival of, and not disease-free survival as well as survival, but survival first, if you look at resection versus RFA for small single lesions, it's quite clear that for small lesions that RFA gives you almost as good, if not better, results than resection. So a small operation, really very low morbidity, and pretty good disease-free survival. Now, this is higher than the disease-free survival that's been seen in other series. But look at 3 years, you had 81% and 84% for RFA, disease-free survival, and 71% at 5 years. That's 5 years from that moment that you've met that patient. Now, that's not to exclude the fact that you could actually have a transplant later if you actually were to recur. There are several other reports. I don't have time to go. I could sit here for hours documenting the efficacy of RFA for small HCCs. Another one, which actually may have been one of Neil's references, 145 patients, survival of resection versus RFA. Look at the RFA survivals at 98%, 87%, and 72% in 1 year. Now, there's no question that the recurrence rates, this is recurrence-free survival on the bottom, for RFA is 86% at 1 year, but that drops down to 74%. Again, 5 years, 67%. Now, you could argue that the recurrence rates, if you're going to compare them to liver transplant has lower recurrence rate, no question about it. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying you can ablate now and see if they recur and then eventually go to liver transplant. You're not excluding these patients for liver transplant. I'm saying maybe you should ablate them now and see if they actually deserve a liver transplant. Now, so what we're arguing, or what Neil argues, is that if you have this guy with a 1.5, 1.9 centimeter tumor, and you're just going to basically wait just in order to have them qualify to get a liver transplant, because that's the only reason why you would wait. Otherwise, if you really thought they had cancer, you'd treat. So the only reason to wait is to make them a liver transplant candidate. Now, is that good for him, and is that good for everyone? So we have to think of both the good of the group and the good of the patient. Now, I know that we're supposed to only think about the patient case right now, But I would argue, sitting here in a conference and as a member of the Liver Intestinal Committee, we have to think about your other patients too, your other patients with liver disease, your other patients with a MELD of 35 that are waiting in the ICU. Now, which one would you give the liver to? If I got the liver offer right now for this guy who's been ablated after 2.2 centimeters and been sitting on the list for 9 months, 18 months, 24 months, hanging out, no recurrent tumor, versus your other patient that you've also referred to me with a MELD of 36 sitting in the ICU and about to die in the next week or two, who do you want me to give that liver to? Well, Neil says we should give it to the liver, the HCC patient, but I'm not so sure that that's the right thing to do. All right, now what about the subset? Now, I'm not saying that patients with HCC shouldn't get liver transplant. They clearly should. But what about this person that has a single lesion that just barely grew to T2? And what are the dropout rates of the patients with HCC versus the patients without HCC? Well, if you compare across the country, it's a huge variation in terms of the dropout rate based on how long patients have to wait to get a liver transplant. If you look in Region 5, it's pretty equal. If not, the HCC patients actually have to wait such a long time that their dropout rate is significant. It's up to 21%. Whereas if you look in Region 3 or other regions, Region 11, Region 10, look at how much lower the HCC dropout rate is for those patients compared to the non-HCC patients. In other words, the HCC patients are enjoying a transplant rate that's very high because they get a fair number of MELD points. And the patients who don't have HCC are dying and dropping out at a much higher rate. So this is my argument, and I think I made this last year, that the HCC patients already have too much priority, except maybe in Region 5. So if this patient were in California, he or she would have to wait a good 12 to 18 months to get to the top, and actually they do suffer a dropout rate that's similar to HCC. But is that true for the single lesion patients that actually barely make T2? Now, the reason why I like Neil is that he is so productive that he presents all these great things, like at the last ASLD. So I'll use his slides to make my argument. He was so nice to give me his slides earlier. So when we examined 400 patients on our waiting list that met T2 criteria, and we made them have MELD exceptions, the question was, is there a subset of patients that never really drop out, that actually don't really need a transplant? In fact, Neil told us there was. If you look at patients that have AFP less than 20 and a single tumor between 2 and 3 centimeters, which is the person that he wants to transplant, and they had a complete response to local regional therapy, they drop out. If you meet all three criteria, look at their dropout rate. All the other patients drop out at a pretty high rate. Those guys should get transplanted, I think. The patient that we were just given hangs out and never drops off the list and just keeps on accruing points and hangs out. And does he really need a liver transplant? I would argue no. And in fact, part of the argument of not to include these folks to get HCC exception points, which we are pushing through the Liver Intestinal Committee, is actually based on these sort of data to say those patients with a single lesion, especially if they're well treated by local regional therapy, shouldn't get any extra points. And I agree with that. So, what should we do? Now, if liver grows, you know, in the organ utopia that Neil might live in, and if livers were all around, I'd consider transplanting everyone with an HCC, absolutely. And it'd be fun, it'd be great, and they do suffer a lower recurrence rate if you transplant. So even, whether you even have liver disease or not, you know, the HCC patients, they do better with a liver transplant. However, you know, you think there are some technical complications for liver transplant. Liver transplant's a slightly bigger operation than an RFA. We still live in the era of recurrent HCV and other things. I know our hepatologist said, oh yeah, hepatitis C is going to be a thing of the past. That's great. I think it probably will be with our new medications at some point. But these are still dangers. And you know, even a quote-unquote straightforward liver transplant is a dangerous operation. I mean, we do have patients who die, and we kill patients with liver transplant sometimes. Liver transplant requires lifelong immunosuppression. Why should we push them towards liver transplant right away? Why can't we just ablate them and see how they do? Because Neil has taught us they do fine for a long time, until they recur. If they recur, I would wholeheartedly agree that they should be referred for liver transplantation. If you refer them to us, we think we'll do well. If you look at the survival and graft survival and patient survival across the United States, it actually varies quite a bit. Down into a low of, you know, even our cousins down the road at UCLA, they have a 77% one-year patient survival, which is much lower than ours. So you have to think about how, what kind of liver that patient might get and how they're going to do with liver transplantation. Of course, I mentioned recurrent disease as a problem with liver transplantation sometimes. So for the good of this patient and for the good of the other patients, for both, I would say for small single HTCs, don't wait, just ablate. The patient not need a liver transplant. In fact, they probably don't in the next several years. And if there is a recurrence, which is not trivial, then I would actually aim for liver transplant because that patient has proven to me that the patient actually needs a liver transplant. This last patient does have portal hypertension, no doubt, platelet count of 46. With a MELD of 9, if the patient didn't have tumor, there'd be no question that you're better served by staying on the waiting list than getting a liver transplant. That cutoff is probably somewhere around MELD of 12 to 15. That patient has a MELD of 9, so you're going to increase his mortality by doing a liver transplant on him, except for the fact that he has cancer. If you can control his cancer, there's no reason to do a liver transplant on that patient. And again, I'm sort of arguing to, you know, decrease my own volume, so I'm happy if you want to refer him for a liver transplant. But I would argue that you need to save the livers for people who actually need a liver transplant. Not that patients, not that he wouldn't do okay with the liver transplant, or you wouldn't get away with just waiting for a little while, let his tumor get to be a little bit bigger, and have him qualify for these points, which are too much, based on our allocation system today, which I hope to change. But think about it. I think that if we save the liver transplants and liver allografts for the people who actually need them, not like this guy, then we'll have more livers to go around for the truly sick patients, for the truly life-saving procedures that we do. Does it make it harder on us? Yes, we'll be transplanting sicker patients with true MELDs, not HCC points. But I would argue that for both the good of this patient and the good of all of our patients, that you just simply ablate, see how they do, and if they need a liver transplant, fine, but not now. Thanks.
Thank you, both of you. Wonderful debate. Any rebuttal from Neil? So let me ask. Rio. So one of the concerns about that we have is, say, for patients who got resection and then you look at recurrence and salvage transplant. You know, the data is really mixed in terms of what percentage of patients actually are salvageable. So what if they recur and develop extrahepatic disease? So that's one of the things that worries me in terms of, you know, like doing resection rather than transplanting these patients or doing RFA. And so I think that we're still waiting for some data on that.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Now, you point out an inequity in the system, which is that resection patients have to recur before they get any points, as opposed to ablation patients who can just continue to accrue points even without a recurrence. I think it's always a danger. Neil showed that some of the patients, if you just let them sit from a T1 and hope to just catch them at T2, some of them, they'll go on to not become liver transplant patients during that waiting time. I think it's always a risk to not think about doing a transplant, but the question is, how big is that risk? And that risk is actually relatively small. Whether you do the ablate first, or even if you ablate and then wait to ablate and ablate at 2 centimeters, either one, the risk is fairly low. So the question is, when you do a recurrence, when you do a resection, will they recur in a fashion that is transplantable? And the answer is sometimes yes and sometimes no. If they recur in a systemic fashion, I would argue that's the biology of the disease. You're not going to cure those patients by liver transplant anyway if they recur in a systemic fashion. If they recur in a locally favorable fashion and you've surveyed them well, then those resection patients could become candidates for salvage transplant, and they actually do pretty well with salvage transplant. I would argue that's what we should do with the RFA patients as well. We should make them have a recurrence before you actually transplant them because you've locally treated the disease, and most of the time, that'll be good. It'll be good for a number of years, at least 3, sometimes 5, sometimes longer. So I would argue that I want to continue to do the liver transplants for HCC patients, particularly those with a very high risk of not doing well by letting them sit for a long time. So multiple tumors of a big size, those with a high AFP, give them a sort of 6-month test of time to make sure they don't have such aggressive disease they're going to recur right away post-transplant. I'm all for transplanting these folks. But for this particular person with a single lesion, less than 2 at that time, I suggest we treat them in a much less invasive way, not commit them to the path of liver transplantation right now at least, and then go ahead and transplant them if they were to recur.
Okay, so thanks very much. Wonderful job, both. So we are kind of running, so we have to move on. But let me just pull some, show of hands. How many of you, one more question, yeah.
There's actually pretty good data that the smaller your tumor is, the more likely RFA is to have a curative, but the data doesn't go out 10 years. I mean, a lot of this mostly caps at 5 years. Some of the studies are at 3 years, but certainly RFA can be curative, especially with a smaller lesion. The numbers probably are, I mentioned a 5-year recurrence-free survival of probably somewhere in the 40 to 60% range for these small lesions. So I think if you're asking about an actual cure, I think it's probably a minority of patients. Maybe, I don't know, I would probably guess around a quarter of patients or less, actually. But certainly RFA can be curative. But to be honest, when you have recurrence, most of the recurrence is not exactly local where that first RFA site was. A lot of it is distant and intrahepatic, obviously, but not at that exact site.
So I would argue that's a second primary, right? So you can say recurrence when it's right next to the site. But if you have a fertile field, the entire liver is cirrhotic, and every single one of those dysplastic nodules can grow up to be a cancer, I agree there's a good chance in 5 years you're going to pop up with another tumor. There's no doubt about that. They're at high risk for making another HCC. But what's to say that's not a completely separate clone of cells that grew up to be an HCC? So it depends on how you define quote-unquote recurrence or another primary. But the fact that you'll get another tumor is relatively high based on the fact that cirrhosis is a precancerous condition. So I have no doubt that, and again, it depends on what your definition of cure is. My definition, it may be that I'm curing the one tumor that you have, but I'm certainly not curing your cirrhosis, and I'm not curing the precancerous state, which is the argument to do liver transplantation to get rid of this precancerous lesion. Again, I'm not arguing against transplantation for HCC. I'm arguing for transplanting the appropriate patients with HCC.
Great. Thank you. So finally, show of hands. Who would like to, for this particular patient, who would like to just ablate, forget about transplant? Show of hands. Okay. And who would like to wait and not ablate? Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.